Welcome to session 362 of the Sunstone Symposium. My name is Kim McCall. I'm on the board of directors of Sunstone, and in that capacity, I invite you to locate any electronic noisemakers you may have brought in with you and disarm them. This session is titled, How the Church and Its Members Could Help End the Genocide in Darfur. Our presenter will be Bob Reese. You can read a tiny bit about him in your program. Long-time, huge contributor to Sunstone, to Dialogue, edited Dialogue for quite a while. Tremendous valued person who values life and peace. And we really appreciate his contributions. The respondent will be Scott Abbott, who may be a tiny bit less familiar. He's director of integral studies at Utah Valley State. He's got a PhD in German from Princeton, and has, in addition to writing several books, translated a book called The German Army and Genocide, Crimes Against War Prisoners, Jews, and Other Civilians. So he brings a wealth of experience to this topic, as well as his experience in Yugoslavia, which you can read about in your program a little bit. Okay. Bob Reese.
Thank you, Kim. Always trying to get my act get together. I'm going to do a kind of combination today of reading my paper and presenting some slides. One of the things I had hoped to do would to spend a little bit more time talking about how we as a community might have a real impact on the people in Darfur on the quantum level. There are two reasons I'm not doing this. One, I don't understand it. But more importantly, it's complicated to explain. But let me show you a couple of slides at the beginning. And this is that we... intuition and non-local intentionality. At the Institute of Heart Math, where I work, we're doing a lot of primary research on intuition and also on how we can communicate across the quantum field. Both of these involve energetic resonance between individuals and non-local objects, which could include other individuals, which creates a coherent communication channel for the transference of energetically encoded quantum holographic information, which means nothing, simply that we can, in fact, communicate from here to someplace beyond here simply by the power of intention. This is a graphic that shows how that communication can take place across energetic fields, and what I hope to do next year, and this shows how the incoherence that we produce in our society prevents that kind of communication. Next year, I'm hoping to make a presentation at the Sunstone Symposium that explains this in more detail. The more energetically coherent and heart-aligned our intention is directed to an object of interest, the greater the resonant energetic link, and thus the ability to interact with a non-local object at the quantum energetic level and gain knowledge of or affect the object's future organization and behavior. What this means is that if a group of us here were really coherent and aligned spiritually and energetically, we could, in fact, impact a group of people someplace else in the world. There's a lot of scientific evidence to demonstrate this, and as I say, I will hope to do that next year when I get my act better together. I wanted to just look at a couple of slides relating to Darfur and then read something of my paper. I don't know how to get rid of that little thing up there. Is there a way? Like that.
Well, oops. That didn't help.
Well, if I come back here, we'll do it. Okay.
Yeah.
There we go. How Mormons can help end the genocide in Darfur. This, for some people, may seem as presumptuous as the presentation I made yesterday about how Mormons can help end the war in Iraq, but I am nothing if not audacious in my suggestions. Genocide, you don't need a definition of this. 450,000 people have died in Sudan, Chad, Darfur. 2.5 million people displaced. It's been a 90% destruction of the villages, the culture, the life of the people who are now refugees in Darfur. Genocide is an exceptional crime. It will only be overcome if extraordinary, ordinary voices unite to summon the world's leaders to action. Barack Obama and Sam Brownback, two unlikely cohorts, but nevertheless united in what they are saying about Darfur. Some children in Darfur drawing pictures of the Janjaweed coming in to kill their families and destroy their villages. Thought this was a powerful poster. What happens in Darfur happens to us all. We are all Africans. Find yourself someplace and more than one there. Gandhi, you must be the change you wish to see in the world. Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. Martin Luther King. Nicholas Kristof, who's been perhaps the most clear and consistent moral voice for Darfur, he's a columnist for the New York Times, said, if our leaders are acquiescing in genocide, that's because we citizens are passive too. If American voters cared about Darfur's genocide as much as they about, say, the Michael Jackson trial, this was written a couple of years ago, or about Paris Hilton or any of the other things that are that occupy. It's interesting that Darfur, on ABC News, Darfur occupied 1% of the news in the past year. As Martin Luther King put it, man's inhumanity to man is not only perpetuated by the vitriolic actions of those who are bad, it is also perpetuated by the vitiating inaction of those who are good. And that's all of us. And I'll come back to this. So let me say a few words about this subject. Had you been living during the 1940s and heard reports that the Nazis planned to systematically exterminate the Jews of Europe, including setting up camps where Jews could be gassed and then incinerated by the hundreds of thousands, would you have done anything to try and stop them? If you had not acted, and you could have, and learned after the war that 6 million Jews had been killed, how would you have felt? In the spring of 1994, when you learned that hundreds of thousands of ethnic Tutsis and Hutu sympathizers were being killed in an ethnic cleansing campaign carried out by extremist Hutu militias in Rwanda, did you act in any way to stop the genocide? In spite of the fact that it was fought with primitive weapons, the Rwandan genocide was executed with startling efficiency. It was the quickest genocide in history. Over a span of 100 days, nearly 1 million people were butchered or beaten to death. If you did not act then, did you later feel any sense of responsibility for what had happened? Those tragic genocides of the past century stand as stark witness against the indifference of both individuals and governments to counter one of the greatest of human evils, the attempted destruction of an entire people. Whatever our reasons, that page was missing somehow. Whatever our reasons for what happened then, we are really left without excuse in the face of the genocide which is happening before our eyes, if we care to look and if we care to listen. I'm going to take one quick moment here and reshuffle my... yes, okay. Genocide is the ultimate expression of blasphemy, since it seeks to destroy the essential purpose of God's creation and the object of His glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of His children. Genocide is also an ultimate act against Christ, since it both increases the burden of His suffering and foreshortens the mortal probation of those who are working out their salvation with fear and trembling. I still am a little bit lost here. I'm back with us. Our enlightened understanding of the plan of salvation and our place in it, including our understanding of the role of our roles as saviors on Mount Zion, which I contend refers to our participating in the redemption of the living as well as the dead, give us as Latter-day Saints a special responsibility to counter evil in the world, including the evil of genocide. What I'm arguing is that Mormons may have a special responsibility to trying to bring peace and healing in such circumstances. If we are indeed the restored Church of Jesus Christ, as we claim, then with that claim comes a higher stewardship. Our dear departed brother and peacemaker Gene England wrote, "There are great wounds in the world that need healing," and he would have added, "We are among those called to do the healing." Does the Church have a moral responsibility to end the genocide? While I believe that it does, I am in no position to speak for the Church. Consistent with its general policy, the Church is electing not to get involved in the political issues surrounding the genocide in Darfur. When asked by the Blobbernacle Times whether the Church would support the Save Darfur Coalition, one of the NGOs most active in trying to stop the genocide, Church spokesman Tom Owen is reported to have said, quote, "The Church seldom enters into nor comments on political issues. However, the Church is standing ready to assist the people of Darfur with volumes of humanitarian aid when and if we are called to do so." While one can understand the Church's reluctance to get involved in what is clearly a complicated international conflict, it is important to note that the Church does get involved in complicated political issues when it sees the issue through what it sees as a moral as opposed to a political lens, as with such issues as prohibition, right-to-work laws, the ERA, and various defense of marriage initiatives. Therefore, one wants to ask, what greater or more compelling moral issue can one imagine than genocide? Preserving family values has meaning only if families themselves are preserved. Although not actively working to end the genocide in Darfur, the Church has sent humanitarian aid to Sudanese refugees in Darfur and Chad. According to Nate Leishman, manager of the Church's Humanitarian Response Program, over the past several years, the Church has channeled relief goods for the refugees through such organizations as UNIFER and Islamic Relief Worldwide. Sadly, he reports, currently 15 containers of goods are being held up in port by the Sudanese government, which is typical of the Sudanese government, by the way. Whatever the response of the institutional Church, I believe that as individual members, Mormon Christians are held to a different, even to a higher moral standard, one that requires us to act on behalf of the very least of these, who, like us, are Christ's brothers and sisters, what Mother Teresa called Jesus in disguise. Although Latter-day Saints live in what has been termed an obedience culture, which was the subject of the last presentation, which means we tend to respond most to instructions and cues from our leaders, the Lord makes it clear in the Doctrine and Covenants that we are to act as agents of good outside of and beyond official culture, church structure, policy, and pronouncements. Quote, "It is not meet that I should command in all things, for he that is compelled in all things, the same as a slothful and not a wise servant. I say men should be anxiously engaged in a good cause and do many things of their own free will and bring to pass much righteousness, for the power is in them, wherein they are agents unto themselves." This means that the Lord expects us to use the power that is within us to take the initiative, to do his work in the world. One of the chief ways in which we can do this, I am convinced, is by cultivating what I spoke of yesterday in my session as a Christian imagination. In fact, our failure to act against genocide and other crimes against humanity represents a catastrophic failure of the Christian imagination. Christ is referred to as the just man, and we become just men and women, his children and participants with him in the work of grace and salvation, as we open our minds and imaginations, both to the suffering of others and to the ways we can reduce and heal that suffering. Gerard Manley Hopkins expresses this idea beautifully in his poem, "As Kingfishers Catch Fire, Dragonflies Draw Flame," which is about Christ in this role. He says the just man, that is Christ, justices, creates justice. He keeps grace, that keeps all of his goings graces. He acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ. That is, we are Christ, acting for him. For Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes not his, to the Father through the features of men's and women's faces. So I so too, I believe, we are called to play, that is, to play the part of, to imagine ourselves in the place of, to play in 10,000 faces, in Auschwitz, in Rwanda, in Palestine, in Iraq, in Darfur. Although Christ's imagination, like his love, was infinite, and ours decidedly finite, ours nevertheless can be both vigorous and expansive. And just as he keeps all of his goings with grace, so we can keep at least some of ours so. With the revelations and blessings of the Restoration, Latter-day Saints should possess the most vivid and the most vital imagination of all of God's creatures. But I think it can be argued we do not. Although there is a genuine, generous, and compassionate impulse among the Mormons, our interest in others tends to be primarily of a proselytizing nature. We labor to teach others about the gospel, but when we find they aren't interested, we tend to lose interest in them. We are generous in paying our tithes and offerings, and although a number of Latter-day Saints are involved in various humanitarian projects throughout the world, most of our compassionate impulses tend to be self-reflexive. We should all be challenged by Mormon's question, "Why do ye adorn yourselves with that which hath no life, and yet suffer the hungry and the needy and the naked and the sick and the afflicted to pass by you and notice them not?" Notice Mormon's emphasis. It's not on our passing by them, which we can easily avoid, but is our ignoring them as they pass by us. I contend that passing by us, as we see them on TV, hear about them on radio, or read about them in the newspaper, is the same, or at least nearly so, as if they were passing by us in reality. The Hebrew and Christian ethic require us to consider others as ourselves. As we read in Leviticus, "But the stranger shall be unto you as one born among you, and thou shalt love him as thyself, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt." Or as Christ taught, "Therefore all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do you even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets." Living the golden rule requires a benevolent, empathetic imagination. As we consider what it means to do unto others as we would have them do unto us, we must also consider what we would want done unto us if we were in the place of the others, having their experience, living their lives. Thus, some part of our spiritual imaginations must touch, even if only tangentially and only momentarily, what it would be like to have had loved ones killed by the Janjaweed militias, our village and way of life destroyed, and be exiles in a foreign land without sufficient food, water, shelter, safety, or security. With such capabilities, we can imagine what it might be like for the men among us to be killed and women and girls raped as we leave the refugee camps to search for fuel. We can imagine what it is like to have a sick and dying child and no medicine or medical care, and to bury our dead in a foreign land without ceremony. We can imagine what it is like to wait, sometimes for years, for the world to respond to our plight and wonder at the hardness of heart that keeps them from doing so. Most of all, if I understand the 25th chapter of Matthew, it compels us to imagine Christ himself on a barren, wind-blown desert in Darfur, Christ in a lean-to shelter without food or water, Christ suffering from illness and no one to attend him, no one to bind up his wounds, Christ holding a starving child in his arms, or Christ himself being that child. John Prendergast tells of an experience he had on a trip he took with Samantha Powers to Darfur in 2004. Quote, "We met a woman, Amina, cooking on the ground. She had fled her village during an attack. Her husband had been shot as soon as he left their hut. She had two of her children on her back and the other two in her arms as about 20 Janjaweed chased her on camels. First, they ripped her 5-year-old son, Adam, from her, and when she stopped running and begged for her child, they told her they would shoot her. So she continued running away from her village that was up in flames. The Janjaweed then tossed Adam into the fire. He was screaming and calling her name, but she had to keep running. Despite her speed, her 7-year-old, Azam, was then taken and shot. She was never able to bury her children." I don't know if you ever saw the film Sophie's Choice, but here you can imagine it being played out on the deserts in Darfur. I'm aware that such imaginative touching of the lives of others can lead to what is sometimes called compassion fatigue, feeling emotionally overwhelmed and even paralyzed. But because our imaginations are finite and our compassion limited, it does not mean that we cannot exercise them to our capacity. I contend that we are much less likely to suffer from an exhaustion of empathy or compassion overload than to their opposites, which are likely forms of indifference. It is our indifference, what the Greeks called asethia, which can be translated spiritual weariness or distress of heart, and which the Catholics classify as the cardinal sin of sloth, that may constitute our greatest sin. We must remember that Paul warns us against becoming weary in well-doing. I would like to suggest a few things that the Church could consider doing to end the genocide in Darfur. First, it could call a special fast for the victims of the genocide. Although the Church does not often call special fasts, I believe the situation in Darfur warrants one. According to Isaac Ferguson of the Church Humanitarian Services Department, special fasts are occasionally proclaimed by the First Presidency when urgent needs arise. Such was the case on May 15, 1845, when, quote, enough was contributed to supply the wants of the poor until harvest. In 1985, church members observed two special fast days and donated more than $10 million to hunger relief and community development projects in Africa, South America, and elsewhere. Members of the Church respond to such official invitations with passionate generosity. I believe sponsoring such a fast and inviting other faith traditions to join in would both show moral leadership and genuine Christian care and at the same time help the Church's image worldwide. The Church could also allow contributions to its humanitarian general fund to be designated specifically for Darfur. The Church's policy is not to allow contributions to be targeted for specific groups or causes. If you called up today and say, I want to donate $1,000 to the people in Darfur, they wouldn't accept it unless you donated it to the general fund. Personally, and this happened to us a couple of years ago, we tried to donate some money to the people in the earthquake in Palestine and in Pakistan, and the Church wouldn't take it, so we had to do it through another organization. But the Church does make exceptions. It made an exception for the victims of the tsunami disaster in Indonesia in 2004 and 5, and that certainly precedents for doing the same in Darfur. The Church could use its vast communications network within its ecclesiastical structure to urge members to support various humanitarian efforts aimed at the Darfur crisis. The Church's ability to marshal its human and financial resources to address critical needs was demonstrated recently in response to such crises as the destruction and devastation brought about by Hurricane Katrina, the flooding in England, etc. But it was also in full force during the Equal Rights Movement and the Defense of Marriage Acts initiatives in various states. In those instances, the Church used priesthood organization to raise funds, organize grassroots campaigns, petition legislators, etc. Imagine the results were President Hinckley to encourage members of the Church to donate to Darfur and to write to their elected representatives. The Church could also encourage members to include victims of Darfur and of the Darfur genocide in their prayers. The Church could also include information about what individual members of the Church are doing to relieve suffering in Darfur in Church publications and on the Church website. And it could take the lead in organizing other churches, synagogues, and mosques to join in interfaith prayers, action strategies, and fundraising activities. In many communities, the Church is very active in interfaith work, and this could certainly happen in relation to Darfur. Individual members of the Church have made positive contributions toward ending the genocide in Darfur. These include organizing and participating in special rallies, contributing funds to NGOs working in Darfur, writing letters to congressional representatives, and other ways. Specific actions members of the Church can take to end the genocide in Darfur are listed in John Cheadle and Don Pendergrass' recent wonderful book called Not on Our Watch, The Mission to End the Genocide in Darfur and Beyond. They suggest six main ways that individuals can help end the genocide in Darfur. And I'll just... Oh, this is something else. Let me just read these ways. First of all, become informed. Knowledge is power. This means reading broadly and becoming fully informed about what our government is and is not doing in Darfur. For example, most Americans believe that our government is aggressively working to end the genocide in Darfur. While the present administration was among the first to label the crisis a genocide and has sent generous relief supplies to the refugees, in many respects, the government response has been both slow and inadequate. One of the main reasons for this is that the Sudanese government, although one of the most tyrannous in the world, is our ally, quote, a crucial intelligent asset to the CIA in the war in terror. My guess is that some of you didn't know that. Nicholas Kristof, again writing in the New York Times, says the State Department was angry when our federal government's Agency for International Development released satellite photos showing the burned villages in Darfur. Citing the efforts of Roger Winter of the Agency for International Development, Kristof says, it was agonizing, he says, to feel Mr. Bush wanted to do the right thing in Sudan and yet see the administration acquiesce on mass murder. Winter said, Khartoum looked the U.S. in the eye and we looked away. And it tells them that they can get away with mass murder. In Monday's New York Times, Kristof listed 11 specific steps that our government could take to demonstrate leadership and produce positive results. Cheadle and Pendergrass list the following steps. Sow seeds, raise awareness, underwrite change by contributing and raising funds. Stop funding the genocide, call for divestment. Create community. By the way, the Utah governor has refused to divest the funds in the retirement funds in Utah from the Schlumberger, who's one of the companies doing a great deal of work in Darfur. So one of the things the people here could do is to write to Governor Huntsman saying you would like him to divest in those funds. Create communities of influence. Keep pushing and pushing, lobbying your government. The recent decision by the UN to send 26,000 peacemakers to Darfur was significantly influenced by grassroots lobbying campaigns. The fact is officials, government officials, whether democratically elected or not, respond to pressure. A specific list of steps for accomplishing these strategies is available in some handouts that I prepared for anyone who may wish to take them afterwards. It includes helpful hints for advocacy initiatives and the seven deadly sins of humanitarian rights activists. In addition, I suggest the following strategies for Latter-day Saints. Involve members of local congregations, and this can be done by informally doing this among friends or formally asking the bishop's permission. Examples include an evening of letter writing, a dinner to raise funds, and supporting local organizations. Encourage your local municipality to issue a proclamation to the UN and to local, state, and federal authorities to end the genocide in Darfur. This is what we did in Santa Cruz. We got the Santa Cruz City Council to issue a proclamation, and there are instructions here if you want to do that in your own community. Include Darfur in your personal fasts and prayers. Write to LDS congressional representatives, most of whom do not have a favorable rating on Darfur. There's an organization called DarfurScores.org. Only Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada, and Gordon Smith, Republican of Oregon, have favorable, well, you might include Imhoff if you call that a gentleman's see. In terms of the House of Representatives, only Tom Udall, Mark Udall, and Jim Matheson have what I would consider an acceptable score. But the preponderance of LDS representatives actually have Ds. Let me suggest a reason why I think Mormons should be especially eager to help with this particular crisis. The victims of the Darfur government's campaign of terror and genocide are black. As such, they join the ranks of black peoples who have been persecuted, reviled, and killed for centuries. Given our dismal history of negative treatment of blacks, especially those from Africa, one could argue that Mormons have a special responsibility to act in situations that deprive blacks of basic rights, especially the right to exist. There is no way to adequately measure the suffering caused by our misguided attitudes toward and treatment of blacks. While the church itself has taken steps since the reversal of its policy denying priesthood ordination to blacks to be more inclusive and to establish special programs for black members among the general populace, perhaps especially in the Intermountain region, the transformation has been anything but ideal. While the church itself has not offered and is unlikely to offer a formal apology for its previous policy and practice, nor indicated that it would be disposed to offer reparations to blacks, I believe that as individual members we can help heal the wounds caused by our past policy and practice and present discriminatory and unchristian behavior toward blacks by being both assertive and generous in our efforts to diminish the suffering of black Africans in Darfur and elsewhere. I have a personal reason for wanting my church and its members to act in the present genocide. One of my distant relatives, Alfred C. Rees, then president of the West German Mission, was a key player in the church's strategy to appease the Nazis before and during the Holocaust. As Alan F. Keel and Douglas Tobler summarize, quote, "In their eagerness to coexist with the Nazi government, American officials of the German church resorted to public relations efforts. Probably the clearest example of this tendency was an article by the West German Mission President Alfred C. Rees entitled In the Land of the Mormons. The article appeared in the special issue of the Nazi Party organ, dated April 14, 1937. In the editor's preface to the article, President Rees is called, quote, the representatives of the church in Germany who, quote, paints for our readers a portrait of Mormonism today, a church which views the new Germany with sympathy and friendship. Whether President Rees originally wrote the article in German or not, the language of the piece abounds in such loaded terms as Volk and race. A picture of Brigham Young who bears the caption, and my German is not good, Fuhrer, the historic and Mormon, the fear of the Mormon pioneers. But the significance of these linguistic gaps is magnified by hindsight. More disturbing is the way President Rees blatantly parallels Mormonism with Nazism. As Rees warms to his topic, Mormonism begins to sound like a fulfillment of Nazi teachings, providing, quote, the practical realization of the German ideal. The common good takes precedence over the individual good. Rees concludes by assuring his readers that, quote, Mormons are people who put this healthy doctrine into action. Reading articles such as this, it would have been easy for a German saint to mistakenly conclude that the seal of official church approval had been placed on the Nazi regime. Tobler and his co-author add, some church members even saw Hitler as God's instrument preparing the world for the millennium. I'm not saying the church's position was wrong. It may well have allowed Mormons to survive during the Third Reich. I am saying there is a reason why Alfred C. Rees was a saint with a small s and Helmut Hubner was a saint with a capital S. I want now to... Pardon? Yeah, my time is just about up, and what I want to do is quickly show you some slides. The best way for me, it seemed, to show what's happening in Darfur is to show mothers and their babies, mothers and their children. So I'm going to do that very quickly. I thought this one was particularly poignant because it reminded me of Mary and Jesus going into Egypt, and then this one, what if it were Mary and Jesus looking out at us from Darfur or from Egypt or wherever they were. So why should we do this? Well, the 25th chapter of Matthew. I think all of us in some way stand condemned before it. Let me close by this statement from Annie Dillard regarding the calling to do the Lord's work by acting on behalf of the defenseless and to heal the wounds of the world. Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who shall stand in his holy place? There is no one but us. There is no one to send, nor a clean hand, nor a pure heart on the face of the earth, nor in the earth, but only us, a generation comforting ourselves with the notion that we have come at an awkward time, that our innocent fathers are all dead, as if innocence had ever been, and our children busy and troubled, and we ourselves unfit, not yet ready, having each of us chosen wrongly, made a false start, failed, yielded to impulse and the tangled comfort of pleasures, and grown exhausted, unable to seek the thread, weak and involved. But there is no one but us. There has never been. It is my prayer, brothers and sisters, that we will be the ones. Thank you.
Bob, can I shut this? That's great. Where does this powerful spirit of activism come from? Bob Rees has it. We see it in other people. How does someone like him come to recognize what he calls a catastrophic failure of the Christian imagination? We saw this, of course, in Gene England, Bob's old friend and my former colleague, when Gene and I worked on academic freedom issues at BYU. That spirit was there. And then when Gene and I both moved to Utah Valley State College, I saw it continue. What happens in a person to make them feel that way, and make them an activist, make them feel so deeply about some issue that they do something about it? I see it in my colleagues Brian and Dennis and Michael, who understand their work in religious studies as tied directly to social justice. There are others, Shirley and Monroe Paxman sitting right here, are activists. What makes them activists? What gives a person that spirit of activist? Looking at Rick's T-shirt, he's got a Mormons for Equality and Social Justice T-shirt on. What draws him to that? Where do the impulses come from? I want to suggest it's not from the church, despite Jane England's valiant essay on why the church is more true than the gospel. I'll try to make this point with four admittedly personal and anecdotal examples, and you judge for yourself whether my experience matches yours, and it may not. So, as a missionary in Germany during the Vietnam War, I lived right close to the university in Cologne and lived with students, and they kept asking, why are you here? Why aren't you home trying to do something about the Vietnam War? And the only answer I could give them, and it's because the only answer I'd been given, so when I was a first-year student at BYU before I went on that mission, all the male students had to go to the De Jong Concert Hall, and Hartman Rector, a former Navy man and a general authority, told us that it was our responsibility to serve in the Vietnam War, and we were doing that because as soon as the soldiers left, the missionaries would move in. That's all I had to go on. And so there I am in Germany. I'm being asked, what about the Vietnam War? And all I can answer is, it's my belief that if I change individual people, eventually it will change the whole world. Well, those students were reading the works of the Frankfurt School, Adorno and Horkheimer and Benjamin and all the others, who were arguing just the opposite. You have to change structures if people are going to have better lives. Second example. When my father was killed in an automobile accident, we were from Farmington, New Mexico. The stake president who owned an automobile dealership spoke at his funeral. And he invited me down to the dealership, had me choose a car for my mother, and he gave it to my mother. This is a wonderful man. He was smart. He was kind, generous. 2 years before that, he was mayor of the town of Farmington. When there were the disruptions of 1974, three high school students from my high school, I was out of high school by then, but they engaged in a practice that was common in the town of rolling Indians. They would go down behind bars and find Indians passed out, and they would beat them up, and they would take their belt buckles and their wallets. Well, these three took three Navajo men out into the countryside and tortured them and killed them. And Navajos hadn't been treated well in the town ever, but now this along with 60s, early 70s activism caused a lot of uproar. There were marches in the streets. Thousands of Navajos marched through the streets of Farmington every week for weeks and weeks. And the day that they announced the sentences for these three boys, two 16-year-olds, one 15-year-old, the sentence was they were remanded to the juvenile detention home in Springer, New Mexico, and they would leave there at the latest when they turned 21. People went nuts, and there was a sheriff's posse parade. Some idiot had brought in a six-man group of cavalry people in 19th-century cavalry uniforms from Texas, and they were in the parade. The activists stepped in front of the horses, and the cavalry guys drew their swords, and there were firecrackers and bucking horses, and finally 50 Indians ended up in jail. The mayor had no tools to deal with this. The Federal Civil Rights Commission sent in a people to investigate. They published a 188-page Farmington report the next year. They found rampant racism, discrimination, brutality. They said Navajos are treated like animals in this town. Here's the mayor's response. This is the man I care for so deeply, LDS stake president who'd been so kind to our family. This is a typical example of how the ever-growing cancer of bureaucracy is dominating and directing our country and the lives of its citizens. This commission would appear to want to drag down each of us to the level of the lowest common denominator, and obviously is advancing the cause of socialism in this country. They advocate that government fill all the needs of the individual rather than achievement through individual effort. This would be impossible to finance, completely contrary to the American way of life and the greatness achieved through the free enterprise system and self-achievement of the individual. Sterling Black, the chairman of that advisory committee, said, "There appears to be little awareness on the part of the general population or elected public office officials of the complex social and economic problems." Why wasn't he equipped to understand social and economic problems? Why was Jay Bybee, a BYU law school graduate, the person who signed the torture memo for Alberto Gonzalez? Why are the two psychologists, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, called the Mormon Mafia? They're the ones training CIA agents to waterboard and torture. Why doesn't the church teach social justice? Why didn't I grow up through the church with a sense for social justice? I'm going to end, and maybe I was just an idiot. That's one possible answer. That's often the answer for my questions. I want to end with a couple of quotations from Stephen Epperson, my dear friend, who was a wonderful Latter-day Saint, wrote a fine book called Mormons and Jews, taught at BYU as a history professor, was fired when he didn't go to priesthood meeting and instead came down here to the park to feed the homeless, and then he didn't get an ecclesiastical endorsement. He came home and told Diana, I'm sorry, I've been fired. She said, Stephen, we can be Americans again. This is from an article Stephen and I published in Dialogue in 1987. And it's a single voice, but it's the two of us, and this is Stephen's experience. Though our backyard is minuscule, still we have room for a rose bush, some pole beans, marigolds, a small wading pool for the boys, and a few square feet of grass. Around 8 fireflies rise and fall, entwined in a glowing rhythm. A neighbor 2 doors down sits in Bermudas and a pork pie hat and smokes a slow cigar. This sliver of an old Polish working-class island in blighted North Philadelphia has its own pleasures. Two nights ago, I dreamed that all the stars disappeared and the old heavens rolled up like a scroll. Elizabeth and I set out to find a terrestrial place where celestial evidence of new heavens would be manifest. Today, I wash clothes in our broken machine. I beat and stir with an old cane, then hang up garments intercalated with socks, little boys' briefs and sheets to dry and flap, whipping in the breeze. I peg them with wooden pins, step back, and see accent marks at scored intervals strung along the taut bowing line, the line bearing our wraps and linen and sacred wear, bearing marks, notes, music. If only I could hear it more clearly. It moves against current so strongly, and its voice is drowned out in quotidian din. Cities. I think how hard it is for me to find God here. As a child, I grew amid archaic, wild landscapes. Not so the city. So much blight, so much toughness. We abandon the cities again and again to the paradigms of Babylon, Sodom, Gomorrah. Abandon them to the Catholic Church and the AME churches, the Bethel Baptist churches, the Holy Spirit Alliance Tabernacle of Prayer. Will we find God in these cities or in Darfur? What Latter-day Saint will find the interpretive ministrational key and gift to liberate these captives for God's kingdom? What new paradigm, what vision alternative do we have? We cannot place the crown upon his kingdom, cannot bind all wounds, sate all hunger, pacify all violence, wipe away all tears, yet he bids, he demands a realm of equity and justice now from our flawed hearts and feeble hands. Finally, Stephen is now a Unitarian minister, where his activism has a place in his religious feeling. Vancouver, go to the website of the Unitarian Church in Vancouver, Canada, and you can read a whole set of Stephen's sermons. This is from a sermon called Wrestling with God. Finally, I take heart in the grave and hopeful moral vision and deeds of those we affirm as prophetic men and women who challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. Women and men like Martin Luther King Jr., Dorothea Dix, and Norbert Capek, for whom God is not the cause of things, whether good, evil, or blindly indifferent, not the cause, but the response. The divine is to be felt, seen, and experienced in our response. May God be manifest and made real in each human liberating act, each human gesture of fidelity and kindness. It is truly within our hands, our minds, our artful response to life, whether the divine will be embodied or banished from our world. The answers we give in response to the question of God and the divine, the models we suggest, the lives we live, really matter. Bob Reese has told us exactly what we might do. Humanitarian aid is needed. Humanitarian aid won't change any of the structures that are causing the troubles in Darfur. And what does it mean to belong to a church that doesn't try to change the structures that keep us poor and that keep us brutalized? What should we be asking of our own church as we ask the same thing of ourselves?
I've sat through many, many sessions of this conference, and I've always felt, you know, when it's question time, there's some sessions people jump to the microphone, other sessions people are not sure what to ask at first, and there's this uncomfortable silence that I recognize from testimony meeting, or because we want them to feel like they said something that mattered to us, so we needed to get to the microphone and say something back. It would be okay with me if we didn't say anything for a couple minutes.
I appreciate that silence. Whenever I go to a performance of King Lear, I don't want anyone ever to applaud. I just want everybody to get up and leave the theater and stay with whatever sacred thoughts that they have. I really appreciate Scott's commentary here. I see Cole Capner here. Cole is a Latter-day Saint who a couple of years ago started on his own with his own money something called Save African Families Enterprise. And Cole and his organization are providing HIV drugs to pregnant mothers in Zimbabwe. Certainly one of the most difficult places in the world to offer help, but certainly one of the ones that is greatly needed. There are a number of Latter-day Saints who feel the call from wherever it comes, do things. And it reminded me of something that Francis Menlove said in our session on war yesterday, quoting Gandhi, what you do will be insignificant, but it is very important that you do it. So we just think, you know, I decide I'm going to try and put 15 minutes a day, which is not as many as it takes me to watch The Daily Show, even with TiVo, to do something about Darfur, to write another letter. I had ordered, and don't know why UPS doesn't work, I'd ordered Save Darfur hand wristbands for all of you, and some banners and some shirts and some things to put on your car. But if you go to savedarfur.org, and if you get this wonderful book, Not on Our Watch, those of you who saw Hotel Rwanda will recognize Don Cheadle's powerful presence there and his voice here. And there are a number of wonderful examples of just common, ordinary Americans, 12-year-old schoolgirl who decides to hold a little fundraiser and raises $1,000 or for Darfur, or a group of college students who decide to set up chapters on their campuses to do something, congregations all over the world that in their small way are doing something, and all of that happens. Annie Dillard also, she's one of my favorite writers, she asked the question, if someone does a good deed and nobody knows about it, it's like a tree falling in the wood, does somebody hear about it? All of those deeds count for something to defeat these powers of darkness and evil in the world, and they are there. But as Annie Dillard said, there's never been anyone but us. So we may have a couple of minutes for questions. I have to catch a shuttle at 5 o'clock to get to the airport, but if anyone has something to say. But I really appreciate Kim's giving us a moment of silence to think about what this means in our lives. Well, I think the question is, we listed a number, talked about a number of things yesterday about what we could do in Iraq. There are, in almost every city, there are local organizations that are Save Darfur organizations. The website, if you just type in Darfur into your computer, it will bring up all kinds of websites of people who are doing things, organizations you can join, places you can contribute, writing letters to your elected officials. They do react. A 1,000 letters, 10,000 letters, 1,000,000 letters. Finally, there is an avalanche that suggests to people that we've got to write something. I mean, our government is in bed with the corrupt president of Darfur. We invite them to come to Washington and to sit down and talk with our elected officials because they are our partners in war on crime. I don't know about you, but that seems, I can't make that work in my mind. So do something is, I think, the most important thing. Brett.
First of all, thank you for that lovely presentation that I think touched us all. What can we do on the local level, perhaps the ward level, to contribute in a meaningful way? Would it be appropriate to have our young men and our young women perhaps be actively engaged in some sort of program, letter writing program, or raising money. That was the first thing actually that came to my mind that I would want my children involved in. My son just actually gave me the book, not on our watch, so he's come to this before I have. Anyway, your comments on what we can do in our wards.
It's a very good question, and I would say if you know there are some bishops who would welcome this, who would say, yeah, let's do it. In our ward, in our little teeny ward in San Lorenzo Valley, every year we raise at least $2,000 to send to orphans in Ecuador or to an African group of, to send to Cole's organization to do something. And that's where we in the ward bulletin, we just say anyone who wants to contribute, this is how you do it, and they can either give contributions to someone or that you can give them the list of organizations. I think I would probably begin, as I think some of my ward members here, we will have a dinner and we'll invite people to come in and we will say, this is what we're doing and we want to write some letters and we want to raise some funds and we can get wristbands for $1.50 and we can sell them for $5 and to anybody who wants to pay them and wear that wristband or that t-shirt or something. If you have an organization, church organization, inclined to get involved in interfaith work, some Latter-day Saints are squirrely about that, but a lot of them aren't. I would start with just a group of compatible friends. I would certainly say, I mean, the young men and young women often do a lot of things. In our state, we go and paint an old Methodist church one day out of the year. We do something for a homeless shelter. Scott really identified this. The other churches really put us to shame in terms of their what they do for social justice. But we can begin doing something. Marion D. Hanks really changed the church's attitude toward both interfaith work, and it was because of him that our missionaries spend a half a day a week doing something in the community. We should, as I said, of all of the Lord's people, if we are who we say we are, we should be doing something. So I think teaching our children, getting friends involved, see whether or not on a ward or even a stake level, there are stake presidents who would welcome an opportunity to do something. There are some who would not think it was a good idea, but doing something. Thank you all very much. And again, anyone who wants to pick up a couple of these handouts, please feel free to come and get them.